Hello, and welcome to the Further Podcast, where we explore the far reaches of the human experience, from missions to Mars, to skydiving, to blowing one's mind with psychoactive substances. These conversations offer insight into how these extreme experiences showcase the human spirit, and just might teach us how to live our everyday lives a bit better. I'm your host, Haley Maria Duran, and I study the effects of psychedelics and other out-there experiences on people's minds and brains. So today we have one of my favorite researchers out there, Dr. Willoughby Britton. And I'm a bit of a fan of like meditation and mindfulness and all of that, like both doing it and from a research side. At one point, I wanted to look at the impact that psychedelics would have on people being able to deepen their meditation practice and whatnot. But then I met Willoughby at Psychedelic Science a few years ago, and she told me a bit about some things about meditation that were quite shocking. She studies the adverse effects of meditation, so meditators in distress. And I think a lot of her work has a lot of relevance to studying psychedelics as well. It's a really interesting story she tells because initially she got into the field of studying meditation, like many people do, because she was really interested in it and kind of bought into the hype and the brand of, you know, meditation being something potentially wellness enhancing. But some of her initial research, which was focused on meditation and sleep, showed that meditation was actually producing insomnia in people. So not necessarily positive. And she then goes into her study about meditators in distress, the contemplative experiences study, which very, very carefully cataloged a variety of negative effects people can have from meditation, which is really one of the more interesting like phenomenological studies out there, just because there's so much that people can experience from meditation. People can have what's called energy-like somatic experiences, or often more commonly known as kundalini awakenings. They can have altered self experiences where they feel like they're not really there anymore, that there's a breakdown of the narrative self where they no longer like identify with their life story. People can have amplification of emotions, lack of emotions, all sorts of things. And I love the nuance that her study conveys. And a lot of her work is just absolutely incredible and inspiring. And then the other thing that Dr. Britton does that is phenomenal is she runs a nonprofit called Cheetah House that provides support for meditators in distress. And it's really interesting because she discusses a lot of the strategies that she uses to work with these people who come to Cheetah House having really mind-bogglingly adverse effects sometimes. So people who, you know, might have become so distraught that they have lost their job, they're, you know, living with their parents or something, and all sorts of crazy things that can happen. I feel like they don't exist. Wild stuff. But anyway, the advice that she gives to them is often quite contradictory to what people often encounter when seeking meditation-related help. So I find that really interesting. She also talks a bit about what people can do to kind of prevent meditation-related harms from happening, which I think was intriguing. And there's also obviously like a good intersection between psychedelic-related adverse effects and meditation-related harms. And she goes into that a little bit, and I think that even though that's not the main focus of the interview, I think there's a tremendous amount that we can learn, the psychedelic field can learn from what Willoughby has done, both from a research angle and from the nonprofit she runs, Cheetah House. So I really enjoyed this interview a lot. So another cool thing is there's actually research going on now looking for participants who've had harms from psychedelics or meditation. And so there are two links in the show notes that you can go to participate if that pertains to you. Hopefully not, but if it does, this is a really good opportunity to contribute to science and our understanding of what can go wrong, so that it can be prevented more in the future, which I think is something that we would all like to see. And people might be like, oh, why are you talking about side effects of meditation? I get a lot out of meditation, actually. It's funny, I actually just put in an application to do a Vipassana retreat in a couple months. So yeah, it's contradictory, but I think by being aware of what can go wrong, you can have a more nuanced understanding of the potential and the power of these altered states. So yeah, it's not all just, oh, you meditate and everything is fixed. Or you do psychedelics and the world is fixed. I think, or you move abroad and everything is fixed. But yeah, you learn a lot. So yeah, lastly, there is a Patreon for the Further podcast. I put a decent amount of work into these episodes to reading the research and, you know, reading books of these experts and getting them on the show. If you find these conversations valuable, you can actually show your support now for as little as $3 a month. So that's less than a cup of coffee, you know, less than your daily drug of caffeine. I think that could be a good choice for people if they like the show to help out. So yeah, there's more coming soon. I interviewed the author of Acid Hype recently, so that will be coming up soon. So yeah, stay tuned for more. All right, so I am here with Dr. Willoughby Britton, who has done a tremendous amount of work examining the adverse effects of meditation, both through a scientific lens and also through running a nonprofit for meditators in distress called Cheetah House. So I'm very glad to be interviewing her today. Maybe you could tell us a bit about how you got interested in this work and why there is a real need to examine meditation-related adverse events.
I first started out as, you know, I got into meditation for personal reasons. I had a friend that committed suicide, and that was my kind of way to manage those emotions. So that was in 1995, I started getting into meditation personally. And I'd say for the first probably 10 years, I was an evangelist, like really trying to push it. And the first study that I ever did on meditation, which was my dissertation, looking at meditation's effects on sleep, and this was like laboratory brainwave-based sleep, were the exact opposite of what I thought. Basically, meditation induced insomnia in the meditation group. And it was a very strong dose related correlation, like 0.8 with meditation practice. So that was the first kind of indication that something, this is like the very first study that I did. Of course, I didn't publish it for many, many years because it wasn't really promoting the brand. And then later on, when I did my residency at Brown University, I worked in an inpatient psych hospital, and there were two yogis that came off retreat and were psychotic. So that was the second kind of indication. And just a lot of interactions that I had with meditation teachers where I would ask questions about these types of difficulties. And they seemed like they weren't like, what? I've never heard of that. They were like, oh, yeah, that happens sometimes. And so it seemed like as a meditation researcher, that was an area that was completely untouched by researchers, and that all the researchers are meditators, and we all want to promote meditation, kind of like psychedelics. So that was I did my first, 15 years of meditation research was all about promoting the benefits, finding the benefits, barely even scratching the surface of, you know, we basically, you say there were no adverse effects in the study. You just make sure you have that statement in your paper somewhere, but you actually never measure them. So I'm guilty of all the sins that I have now learned to put in my papers, but that was the beginning. And I think that, you know, meditation, like many other sort of popular treatments, was, you know, very biased in terms of everybody who was a researcher was out to promote it and wasn't really interested in. There was nothing to be gained from having negative effects. And so nobody really wanted to, you know, it was like kind of don't ask, don't tell kind of mentality. And that's not really responsible research. And that's not really responsible clinical, you know, approach. Like, you should have any kind of treatment should go through the basic, you know, NIH phases of treatment development. Phase one is like treatment safety and feasibility. And because meditation basically it sort of got in through the back door because it had all this history of being kind of this technique that already existed. It was like, oh, well, we don't need to test it for safety because it's been around for millennia. And so it kind of skipped that process, which was a major oversight and also just a symptom of the sort of exceptionalism that comes with meditation. Like, it should somehow be an exception to all the rules of every other treatment, which is, I think, a major problem. So those are all things that I engaged in and have subsequently hopefully matured out of them and started to treat meditation the same way as any other treatment. And I think at the beginning, when I first started doing this in probably the early, mid-2000s, there was a lot of pushback. And now, 15 years later, I think that the field in general has gone through its bubble phase, its overhype phase, and is now kind of landing a little bit more in a more moderate stance where, like, of course, all treatments can have side effects. All treatments are optimally suited for certain people and not others. And how do we just find out more about that and get over the defensiveness about it? But we're there, but there's also, you know, some remaining residuals of people who just don't want to hear it at all.
There's definitely a lot of parallels with psychedelic science, how, like, there's a real urge in the field for a while, I think, to develop a brand where it's like, oh, this is very safe and medicalized and you'll be treated like easily and whatever. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of, from the ground up, work examining like what could go wrong. And one thing that I really like about your work with meditation is you seem to have gone into it without a lot of assumptions about what the side effects could be through doing really in-depth qualitative studies with a bunch of people. So maybe you could tell us a bit about your study of adverse meditation-related experiences.
Yeah, so when you're starting a new field in an area where there's really not much known, then there are certain kinds of methodologies that are more appropriate. And so doing an interview-based, largely unstructured interview where you don't have a lot of preconceived notions and you just kind of ask people to describe their experience, then you get like what's called rich descriptions, and you can really, that's the foundation. So basically, the Varieties of Contemplative Experience study was a pretty simple design in that we went around to meditation centers and we talked to teachers that had been teaching for decades and ran, you know, retreat centers. And we asked them, you know, what types of difficulties have you seen? How do you make sense of them? And how do you manage? What do you do about it? And then a lot of those teachers would start to tell us their stories of sort of their worst case scenarios. And then they would, you know, if the person that they were talking about was still alive, they would say, oh, maybe that person will talk to you and let me check in with them. And then they'd kind of hook us up with their worst case scenarios. Interestingly, many of the teachers that we interviewed midway through their interview, they would say things like, well, when this happened to me. And so actually a lot of teachers themselves have had difficulties. In fact, 60% of the sample of the people who had had themselves difficulties were teachers. So that was the beginning of the VCE study. It took us 10 years to collect all the data and to analyze it. And so it was about 3,000 pages of transcripts, interview transcripts. And I think we had over 100 interviews total. 68 were people who had had meditation troubles themselves, and then 32 were meditation teachers or clinicians. And we did a lot of different kinds of coding, but there was one code for phenomenology where we came up with 59 categories of meditation-related challenges. And then there was a code system for influencing factors, so factors that can influence the trajectory or severity of the symptoms, the duration. And we came up with 26 influencing factors.
So definitely, it seems like people can have a lot of very different experiences. There's a variety of ways you could have like these adverse things happen. What were some of the sort of major categories? Like, I understand that a lot of people can have really altered like self-experience from meditation, and that can be a huge problem. Somatic experiences.
So, I mean, we came up with the 59 categories are divided into 7 domains. And so what's interesting is that meditation-related experiences, effects, can span almost every domain of human experience. So the cognitive domain, changes in thinking, which can bleed into delusions, loss of the ability to think at all and have no thoughts whatsoever, which is called mind emptiness, and then the opposite, like racing thoughts that are almost moving too fast. You can have changes in perception. So things like most common, you know, within 5 minutes of meditating, you can start to see that colors get brighter. You can also have, you know, that can go all the way into hypersensitivity to sound and light, and even visual hallucinations, visual snow, the first paper that I ever wrote was on lights, like light changes in sort of luminance, and also just light hallucinations, kind of like Christmas lights. All kinds of perceptual changes. And then emotional changes can basically an increase in any kind of emotion that you can possibly have. Rage, fear is the most common, euphoria, but also a complete lack of emotion. So people report losing all emotion whatsoever, which they call equanimity hell. also in the emotional domain, re-experiencing of traumatic memories, or just like flooding of emotions with no apparent source. And somatic changes, so bodily changes, can be like changes in your bodily, just feeling of your body. You can have pain syndromes. You can have, you know, strange distortions, ELSAs, which is energy-like somatic experiences, changes in sleep, usually insomnia, but sometimes also hypersomnia, changes in appetite, people lose their appetite, changes in sexuality, sometimes complete loss of libido or hypersexuality. So it's just a huge range. And then changes in sense of self was a whole other paper that we wrote. So yeah, a lot of different kinds of changes in sense of self, mostly loss of different senses of self, not usually a gain, but there can be, you know, kind of a grandiosity, you know, sense of inflated self as well.
Going from there, it like there's so many different paths somebody could end up on that are problematic, it seems, with meditation. Do you have any idea of like what might like predict what sort of adverse effects a person might experience? Maybe if we understand like how these different paths, I guess, form, then we can try to prevent them or try to screen people out or do something.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, so in terms of risk factors, you know, we looked at all the, I mean, asking about risk factors was one of the things we asked teachers. And we looked at all the kind of obvious risk factors, and they didn't pan out as big as risk factors as we thought. So for example, I think a lot of people, there's a what we call the the ultimate attribution error, or the fundamental attribution error, which is basically to take, when bad things happen, blame the person, not the environment, or the circumstances. And so there's a lot of victim blaming that goes on and trying to find out, like, what's wrong with this person that they had this adverse effect. So we did look at, so we heard that, like, having a prior psych history or trauma history, like, that was a major risk factor. And it's still a risk factor, but what was interesting was that there were plenty of people in our study who had very severe adverse effects and ended up, hospitalized or, on antipsychotics or something, who had no prior psychiatric history whatsoever, no genetic, risk factors in their family, grew up in a loving family, just no red flags at all. So just to take that risk factor, with a grain of salt, and just to know that it can happen under optimal circumstances when people have no psych history, are meditating correctly, are meditating, with adequate supervision. Those are all things that are often used as sort of reasons that the person did something wrong. But I think it's much more complicated than that. We have 26 influencing factors, and, similar to psychedelics, there's a set and setting kind of, what did the meditator go into? It's often a retreat. What kind of mentality do they have? What kind of expectations? And it's not just something that's sort of exists within the meditator. It's something that is given to them by the culture around them, like the teachers and the Sangha members and the internet, like, are all feeding into, like, these expectations. A lot of the metaphors and models are out there already, and that's already pre-existing in the person and also often within the instructions themselves. So that's all leading to it. And then, if you start to run into problems, like, is there somebody there to guide you out of them? Or are they, like, just keep going and doing the same exact thing? And, like, that doesn't usually go so well. So, mm-hmm. There's a lot of, and then how does the person respond to the problems? Like, what kind of instructions were they given to, are they seeing them as problems? Are they seeing them as progress? It's just, there are so many different factors. And then also, like, in often meditator sort of culture is there's a certain, like, diet and lifestyle that goes with that. So a lot of meditators are vegetarians. Almost all retreats are vegetarian, and sometimes only feed you twice a day and they don't have dinner. So people are, like, radically changing the way they eat. And so there's a lot of, we actually did a study. This was actually just a study on, mindfulness-based interventions. So not like super Buddhist versions of meditation, but we found that, we're like, everybody's calling me these interventions, like, mindfulness interventions. And then when you get the, the effects, like changes in anxiety or depression or whatever, like, you call it, like, the effect of meditation. But we're like, wait, there's a teacher, there's a whole group, like, this is like, what about the psychotherapy part? And so we look to see whether the main ingredients of psychotherapy are called common factors. And what's been found in psychotherapy research is that it doesn't actually matter what kind of psychotherapy you're doing. What matters is, like, basic qualities of the therapist and of the like relationship. So is the therapist, like, warm? Are they seem like they're listening to you? Do they try to make an effort to understand your perspective and your values and your goals? Or are they just, like, talking over you and just, imposing their viewpoint? So, there's some basic, common factors. And so we basically did a common factors analysis, using the same, like, measures that they use in psychotherapy for the mindfulness program. And this was in this particular study, it was a dismantling study. So we were looking at the effects of different types of practices. And so what we found was that the common factors, so the relationship with what they call the therapeutic alliance with the teacher, and then even more so with the other group members of the class was more important than what type of meditation you did or how much. And so it's just like, you know, it's just this red herring where you're like, oh, the meditation class had this effect and therefore it was the meditation. But it was like, maybe it was the people you met, and maybe it was the, you know, when you debrief after your meditation and you share your experience with somebody else, like that's what was carrying the benefit. So I think that there's some massive biases in the way that we do research and the way that we communicate research to the public. And I think psychedelics is very, very similar in that there's a whole bunch going on besides the actual drug ingestion. Like there's so much around that that's going to have so much of an effect too.
Yeah. Context is really important. I think a lot of people don't really pay that much attention to it. So it's great that you're really highlighting how much of a role that can play in people having adverse effects. I wonder what the psychedelic field kind of could learn from like the work that you've done with meditation, because it seems like there's a lot of underlying similarities, both with the experience of like meditation itself, and then also the media hype and the brand building that has kind of developed around the psychedelic field.
Yeah, so my colleague and I, Roman Politsky, we wrote a paper on how can the psychedelic world leverage what we've learned from the meditation, you know, developing and learning about adverse effects in meditation, how can that be transferred over to the psychedelic world? So we wrote a paper on that, and we're also conducting a parallel arm study that's actually actively recruiting right now. So there's an arm on psychedelics, and the URL for that is psychedeliccallenges.org. And then there's an arm for the meditators, which is meditationchallenges.org. And this is basically, it took me like 4 years to create all the questionnaires because there's so many leftover questions from the Varieties Project. And so then with qualitative data, you can't really get at, you know, predictors or risk factors. You need a large sample, and you need to be able to do like quantitative statistics on that. So we basically needed a very different kind of approach, which was basically all survey, everything's numerical, and then you can analyze all the questions that we can't answer with the VCE study. And so, yeah, like what are the most troublesome symptoms? You know, which are the ones that get people into trouble like the longest? Or, you know, the question that you had, which was like, which types of senses of self are affected differently with psychedelics versus meditation? Like, that's a question that, you know, you really need a parallel arm study to do. You can't just kind of guess across studies, one study that uses one, you know, one type of scale on senses of self versus, you know, another study on meditation that uses a different scale. You can't really compare those, especially if the differences are very subtle. We have, and then questions about, lots and lots of questions about the context and like what type of context is supportive and helping people and what type of contexts are harming people, especially the ones that are, that I see at Cheetah House over and over again that are kind of the default, and people assume that they're good or that they're helpful, but they've never been actually evaluated. And I'm hearing reports that they're very problematic. So things like the default response to meditation difficulties is just notice it, you know, you're making it into a problem. So just stop reacting to it and go back and observe it and just keep meditating. Just keep doing what you were doing. That's an extremely common response. And one that the meditators that I talk to are like, that was the most harmful thing that someone could have said. Like, why didn't they hear me? This was a problem. Or this isn't a problem. This is just part of, you know, some kind of purification narrative. Like, you know, you're getting out the bad stuff, you know, whatever, whether that's trauma or whether that's karma or, you know, contaminated energy, whatever kind of model there's that you're using, there's often a purification narrative. And I've gotten really interested in like, where did that come from? And, you know, historically for hundreds and hundreds of years, our medical model was based on the four humors, humoral medicine. Just basically this idea that like our body, but also our mind and our emotions is running on these like fluids, you know, black bile, yellow bile, phlegm and blood that are just like, that all have different sort of qualities to them. And they're moving through our bodies, like almost like plumbing pipes, and that they can get like stopped up or they can get imbalanced. And often the way to balance them was to, you know, drain the pipes, you know, bloodletting or vomiting or, you know, excessive sweating or some way of like purging it, you know, purifying the system. And that, and I've read a number of, you know, recent kind of ethnographic, sociological kind of reviews that are like, people are still using this model in new recycled ways, but in contemporary times. And I think that like that there's also this, a related theory called the hydraulic theory of emotion. Again, where this idea that like buildup causes sort of problems, and that a release, some kind of release or discharge of this buildup is the solution. So I think that that's a really common model, and that's just not the way it works. Like we know that like Freud had this idea that, you know, catharsis was the cure, and we know that that's been debunked, at least in terms of anger. And I've read stories about, not stories, I've read research about, you know, crying. Like, is crying always good for you? And people often, if you ask them retrospectively, they often say yes, because they already know that they already are biased by the idea that crying is good for you. And so that's basically affecting the way that they appraise how crying affected them. But if you do a prospective study and you track their mood across time before and after crying, then the data changes dramatically, and like only a third of crying episodes actually feel beneficial. So, you know, this is sort of what I'm thinking about and working on currently, is just trying to understand these models that are so commonly applied both in meditation and psychedelics, but also in a lot of psychotherapies, and how they're based on this very intuitive folk notion, but that's not based in data, and is also people are reporting that it's basically dysregulating them, that it's causing problems. I mean, bloodletting killed people, so it's not really surprising that that's not a great model, but it's very, very alive and well in both.
It's definitely tricky dealing with the sort of narratives and frameworks that can emerge surrounding meditation, like, oh, you just need to sit with it more and all of that. But sometimes the frameworks that develop can be somewhat helpful for people in some circumstances, like calling something a kundalini awakening that a psychiatrist might call like a manic episode or even psychosis-like. In some ways, I imagine that could be like kind of destigmatizing and normalize it. Like it makes it seem more normal for people. So that could be good on one hand, but also if people aren't getting like the help that they need, it's tricky. And a lot of these things are they're just so embedded in the culture that people aren't really aware of all the kind of folk knowledge that exists in like the psychedelic space.
I mean, I think the way that I work with it at Cheetah House is like, all interpreter frameworks like have consequences. And so to really talk with each person and figure out like, what are the consequences, full range, both benefits and drawbacks of each of these kind of worldviews or interpreter frameworks, and make sure that those are consequences that the person wants. And so like, yes, it's true that, you know, the Kundalini awakening is a very, very popular model because it is very destigmatizing. And, you know, I'd much rather feel special and, you know, somewhat, you know, spiritually, I don't know, advanced than sick and broken, right? Like, that's an obvious benefit. But if you dig deeper, then especially with people who are having more like psychotic symptoms, I used to be like, you know, extremely person-centered to be like, and really, really want to honor, you know, whatever value system somebody takes on, like honor their religious and spiritual orientations and not impose anything else, especially psychiatric. But I also have learned that the duration of untreated illness, whether it's for, and this is specific for mania and psychosis, is directly related to the probability of having a long-term chronic disability. And so if I spend a lot of time honoring their, you know, this is not any kind of psychiatric problem, this is just me having a Kundalini awakening, and I just honor that and honor that and honor that for years, I'm actually making it more likely that they are going to not only have a long-term, you know, disorder, but also one that will no longer respond to medication. And so, you know, so it's an ethical dilemma. There's no right answer to this, but in my mind, like having seen people really kind of lose their lives because they have a psychotic illness that is not responding to medication, and they really, you know, their parents can't take care of them anymore. They're really like dysfunctional. I would rather give somebody the choice, like get them on medication early on, and then they can kind of decide how they want to go from there. But if you miss that opportunity, then they might not have a choice later. So yeah, I've changed a lot on that trajectory. I also find that the Kundalini awakening model, you know, it very much discourages taking medication. And I've also seen people lose years and sometimes decades of their lives because they're waiting for this magical thing to kind of do its process that's going to make everything better, which is kind of the promise. Like, this is, you know, you're in some sort of spiritual awakening, and eventually it's going to be good. Eventually it's going to pay off, and you're going to be, you know, everything's going to be better. But I just haven't seen that happen in a lot of people that have taken on that modality. And eventually a lot of them are like, it's been 10 years. Like, all of my friends have like moved on. They have jobs, they have families, they are happy. And I am still like struggling with this, all these symptoms. This is all I do all the time. Like, I don't care. I don't care about being enlightened or spiritually advanced anymore. I just want to like have a normal life. So I also see that. So I think it's just important to take it on a case by case basis and, you know, figure out what the person really wants and whether the framework is supporting that.
Yeah, I guess that kind of gets into how do you help people who have these challenges in general? Like, if somebody is having a problem with meditation or a problem like related to psychedelics, what are some things that they could do that could be beneficial potentially?
I mean, kind of in order of like sort of chronological order, like at the beginning, before you start, I think it's really important to kind of clarify your goals. Like, what is it that you want? Like, what would better look like? And then really paint like the most concrete picture, like using what, like SMART goals, you know, specific, measurable. I forget what the other ones stand for, but you know, something that you can really measure, not just like, I want to feel better, but like, what did that look like? Well, it's like, I will cry myself to sleep less often. You know, I will like go leave the house like more than once a week. Like, I will have more than one friend. I will, you know, like really paint it out. Exactly. Like, how many, what kinds of emotions will you have? Like, well, how many, you know, negative emotions versus positive emotions? Like, what types of thoughts will you have? What will you be doing? Who will be around you? Like, really paint a picture, a creative writing exercise, but like with measurable And then, like, what would not be acceptable? You know, like, because you don't want to just paint the picture. You also want to be like, I don't want to spend like half my days in bed. I don't want to have to be going to the doctor more often, or the psychiatrist or the therapist more often than I am now. You know, like, set some boundaries for, like, what would be an indicator that whatever you're about to do is not working. You know, so, like, there's a great song by Amy Mann that she says, prepare a list of what you need before you sign away the deed. You know, like, really make a list of what's going to be, like, because once you engage in an altered state of consciousness, you might lose, and especially one that's being very, very influenced by other people who have their own agendas and goals and values, that, like, it's very easy to lose sense of what you wanted and basically start to sort of play out somebody else's value system, because they're, you know, you're that's the system that you enter into, a system. And then if you don't have that list with you, then it's really easy to get lost. So that's the first thing, is just clarifying what you need. And then I actually have a course that I created, because this is so common, where people are meditating and they can't really tell, like, whether they should be, whether it's helping or not, or it's like, or it's having very mixed effects. And so I have a whole system called MyMap, my meditation assessment process. You could also use it for anything else, like psychedelics. You could use it for, like, is this relationship good for me? Is this job good for me? Is this location of where I live good for me? It could be used for anything. But basically, you just make a list of all the goals of what you wanted from this thing. So for meditation, it would be like, well, I want a way to center myself. I want a way to kind of recollect myself after coming back from work or whatever, you know, a way of a punctuation mark. I want a way to connect with, you know, the world, something larger than myself. I want to be part of a lineage. I want to have a comprehensive sort of meaning system, you know, a grand meta narrative, like, whatever it is, like, just, these are just common ones, but, you know, making a list and then going across with each different practice you've done, like, how well is this practice meeting this particular need? And I actually use Excel, and Excel is cool because you can change the color of each cell. And then you can basically, once you've done all this, and this is, I do it for practices like in the past, but also now, because often people have a really positive experience to a practice, like, in the past, but then if they fill it out again, like, let's say it's breath awareness, like, you know, initially it was like really calming, and now it's like having this anxiety effect. And so when you do it like that, you're like, oh, like, it used to be really good, but now it's not. And so if you color code that, like, green is like, go, you can, you know, thumbs up, keep going using this. Red is like, no, it's having adverse effects. It's having the opposite effect. Stop. When you map out the Excel sheet and you stand back, you can really see, like, where, okay, this particular meditation is getting all green, you know, all the way down the, you know, down the, then you keep doing that one. And another one might be all red. And then the last question is, are there other things in your life that are actually maybe better at meeting these specific goals? So, you know, maybe it's making friends. Maybe going to meditation center isn't the best place to meet friends or a partner. Maybe that's, you need to do something else, join a gym or something. So that's, you know, that's the sort of first process of how, you know, not losing yourself along the way, being clear about your values, and then having some kind of systematic way of assessing whether the drug or the, you know, the retreat or the meditation is having the desired effect. So some way of, you know, testing it according to your own value system of whether it's working for you. And then, you know, there are what are usually called trauma-informed modifications. And this is really only because people with trauma histories can have a particularly bad interaction with meditation. And so it became a very vocal group that was like calling for modifications. But I think I like the term diversity informed, and that it's just like, can you make meditation, you know, available to a wide range of people, regardless of whether it's trauma or some other way that they're different from the average. And so there are some things you can play with. I mean, obviously duration or dose is one thing you can play with. So just like back off and like do much shorter practices. Often adding a movement element can often change the dynamic. And I mean, this is often for people who, so a very, very common dynamic is people who do some kind of concentration practice or just some kind of intensive practice, usually concentration or insight, and they develop some kind of anxiety problem, like anxiety, panic, insomnia, like all kinds of hyperarousal symptoms. And so for those types of people, you know, backing off, doing like widening the aperture of awareness, so it's not so focused, that can change. Introducing some kind of movement, sometimes like yoga or Tai Chi or walking meditation, but also even just moving your eyes and not getting locked into some kind of immobility can help. And then, I mean, I introduced something called scaffolding at Cheetah House, and that's more of like a person-directed investigation of ways to modify your own practice or your own nervous system, but within your own meaning system. Because a lot of people, one of the harms that happens is that their entire meaning system, their entire like way of, you know, interpreting their own experience, their agency, their autonomy has been completely violated by, you know, whatever system they walked into. So the meditation teacher, the instructions, the community, just the whole thing has basically just been, you know, kind of a violation, extreme disempowerment. And so a lot of people have kind of religious trauma, ideological trauma. And so even going to a therapist who's like, okay, we're going to do CBT and like, that's a thing. And like, you're going to follow my instructions. Like that itself is so traumatic because it's like already a system that they're being asked to kind of like surrender to. And so scaffolding is like, okay, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but like, I'll ask you questions about like what around you right now, if you're in your house, like, is like, what direction do you want your nervous system to go in? And let's say you say, I don't know, calm and empowered. Now look around the room. Is there anything that seems to have that, you know, effect on you just a little bit? And then we'll spend an hour unpacking that object. And I'm not going to tell you anything. I'm going to just say like, oh, when you said that, you talked about that photo that's on your piano, and you talked about that trip you took with your aunt, and you said how much your aunt, how badass she was. You really like your energy really changed, and you looked, you know, really strong and empowered at that moment. You know, I'll mirror it back to you, so you know it's not the trip, it's the aunt. You know, and then you can use that aunt in the future as, you know, someone to call on if you need. A resource that is sort of empowering to you. And so scaffolding is like, you know, I could spend hours and hours talking about what scaffolding is, but that's the basic idea, is giving somebody something that can modulate their nervous system in a way that is 100% theirs. And it's going to work a lot better if it's your own meaning system rather than having to adapt to some foreign meaning system that someone else created, often based on some, you know, kind of external culture that's usually not the one you grew up in.
Yeah, it sounds like, I don't know, just the intentionality you described with evaluating whether or not a meditation practice is good for you or whatever, like if people were just that intentional in general in their daily life and aware of what their goals were and their values are, then I think a lot of people would do a lot better anyways. So, but it's a great thing to think about. And I think a lot of people who do psychedelics or who do start a meditation practice, oftentimes they're not really clear of their goals. They're just like, I want to feel better. And they think that, yeah.
Well, I mean, it kind of blows my mind that we like, I talk about this in the mind map process too, but like I spend, and I know a lot of people spend like a lot of time figuring out like which olive oil to buy, right? Or like what kind of toilet paper to use, or like, you know, like there's entire websites that are like, you know, how do you find the best TV or the whatever, like, you know, Wirecutter has these like lists of the best pillows or the best blankets or whatever. And we don't do that with meditation. It's like people they go on retreats that their friends went on, or they download Headspace because they spend the most money on advertising. It's like, this is up there with like finding a life partner. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to allow somebody to go into your mind and modify it. And this is true for psychedelics too. Like, this is an incredibly intimate and potentially, you know, just like relationships can be like amazing or like the worst possible, terrorizing, worst, most traumatic thing possible. Like, that's what this is. And you got to be like, I think having a lot, you know, this whole, I trust the process, like that's bullshit. You know, like we want to like be, you know, be extremely attuned to your red flags, be extremely attuned to like any kind of sense of trepidation, because that's going to save you. So I think being extremely cautious and being extremely demanding about like quality is, and you know, you don't necessarily know whether you can trust someone on day one. Like, that's a very, like, be slowly, like, try something out, be open-minded, but also, like, don't move too fast. And just think of it as a relationship, like a serious relationship. Like, you want to take it slow, get to know somebody before you, like, put the ring on the finger, you know? So, I don't know. I think it's harder to do. It's easier to do with meditation because you can do a smaller amount. It's harder to do with psychedelics because it's like you either like ingest the drug or you don't, you know? It's like, yes, you can microdose, but I don't know. I think it's harder to dip your foot in, but I think you can still test out the container, the people in the container. Are they people that seem like they're mature and have a balanced view of things? And one of the things I suggest people do is like ask really hard, challenging questions that sort of threaten the, like, criticize the brand and see what happens. You know, like ask questions about adverse effects, and if people like completely dismiss them and say there are none, or that our particular, you know, brand is free of them because we do X, Y, and Z, then you can run for the hills. But I think it's good to ask those questions and just see how you're received, because that is going to be how you're received if you have problems later on. And if they just deny that you're having them before they even start, then that, you know, you want to have people say like, yes, that can happen, and here's what we do when that happens. And they have a very long, extensive plan and lots and lots and lots of stories where they've actually helped people through, rather than like, we have this theoretical plan that we've never used.
Yeah, that for a long time, I feel like the psychedelic field didn't even acknowledge, like, in papers that adverse events were really happening. So, I mean, that's like a problem with the whole field. And yeah, I do think it's really great when a community or a framework could show, like, yeah, there have been people who've had difficult times, but they've came through it and are now fine. One thing that I think it's interesting that Cheetah House does is you have letters to my former self, where you have people who've gone through a bunch of difficult experiences telling their story. And I would love to see something like that with psychedelics.
I mean, one of the letters to my former self was Rachel Peterson, who was in, I believe, the Johns Hopkins trial. And, or she was in some kind of clinical trial for psychedelic psilocybin and had a like very destabilizing experience. and then classically was told to go on a meditation retreat to recover. And of course, that doubly went terrible. And she wrote an article in the Harvard Divinity Bulletin, I believe, describing, it's called a theological reckoning with bad trips. But she got invited to Cheetah House because there was a meditation component. And interestingly, a number of psychedelic users who had difficulties, we have our 59 categories of meditation challenges posted on the website with descriptions, basically our entire codebook. And a lot of psychedelic users are like, that's what happened to me. This is the best, most accurate list that I've seen anywhere. And like, I know this isn't from meditation, but can I talk to you? So we do not intend to be a support service for psychedelic users, but we are, because we don't turn people away if they want help. And so we have a number of people that come to Cheetah House because of psychedelics. And then there's a massive overlap between psychedelics and meditation. So often there are these cases where people like Rachel, where they had a difficulty with psychedelics and then are told to, you know, integrate it with meditation, and that doesn't go well. Or the opposite, where people have a difficulty, you know, a meditation-related difficulty, and are completely destabilized and don't know what to do about it. And they're like, I'll take psychedelics to try to fix it. And that doesn't go well. And so we also have those sort of dual user situations as well. But it's interesting. And I've seen a lot of people who come to Cheetah House, and they've said, I was like, aren't there integration services? I feel like there's integration services with like every single possible, you know, place that offers psychedelics. Like they also offer integration services. I see them all over the place. Like, have you tried that? And they're like, oh yeah, I've tried all of them. And so that also makes me wonder, like, what is going on with this integration services that they're ending up at this other support service, which isn't even for psychedelics. It makes me a little worried that the integration services are just recycling the same problematic models that kind of got people in trouble in the first place. Mm-hmm. But I will say that all of this is going to be, this is on the questionnaire that we're, as part of our research, is like, what did you do as a result of your challenges? What did you try? And importantly, you know, what worked, but also what didn't work. We need the list of things that didn't work, because so many people come to Cheetah House with, you know, a list of 50 things they've tried and that didn't work. And so like, we need to know about those so people don't waste their time.
Besides integration circles not really working, which integration circles can sometimes be just like, integration feels a bit like a empty buzzword, where sometimes it's just people sitting around telling their stories over and nothing really happens. So I think maybe that's why maybe people aren't being helped compared to the more sort of action oriented processes you described, with like scaffolding and being clear on your values and whatnot. But besides from like integration not working, what else are some common things that people might turn to that might not be helpful both for meditation or psychedelic use?
So one of the most common sort of mistakes that I see with meditators in distress is that they go, you know, they've already talked to the meditation teachers who are like, just keep meditating, or like, you know, you need grounding. So like, put your feet in the soil, you know, just they're like, I need a little more than that. Like, I haven't slept in a week kind of thing. And so they know that they need therapy. And they often choose their therapist because their therapist says they know about meditation, which makes sense, because you want somebody to understand you. If you got yourself into trouble with meditation, you want somebody that like knows about meditation. But the problem is that often those therapists are extremely committed to meditation being a good thing. Sometimes they're like very committed Buddhists. And so the person comes in and is like, my problem came from meditation. And they're like, oh no, meditation has no side effects. You can't, you know, so they completely deny them, which is not what a good therapist should do, like right off the bat. Or they engage in the same kinds of problematic models that they got earlier, which is like, oh, you need to go on a retreat and like, you know, really get to the bottom of this and like kind of work it out. Or, you know, this isn't a meditation problem. It's really sort of part of the path of awakening. And this is actually a good thing, you know, where like the person's like, you're not hearing me. Like, I'm not sleeping. I can't work. Like, you know, I mean, some people's stories are like complete devastation of their entire life. Like, they went from having like an advanced degree to living with their parents and, you know, their husband leaving them and losing custody of their kids. I mean, it can be really extreme. And so for those people, they're like, I need help. Are you listening? You know, and like sometimes the thing that's going to get them back on their feet the fastest is medication. And sometimes, you know, heavy lifting medication like antipsychotics, sometimes something a little less like that, like, you know, some benzodiazepine or a mood stabilizer. But and often just, you know, just the run of the mill SSRI can also be very stabilizing. And so I don't take anything off the table ideologically. Like, if it helps, then it's on the table. But I think that there are certain kinds of cultures that like they're really anti-psychiatry, or they're anti-biomedicine, or, you know, and it's like, that's, you shouldn't rule anything out like from the onset.
Yeah, I think a lot of people really aren't aware of how like severe meditation related adverse effects can be, like you described, with people, you know, who have like advanced degrees, losing everything, and just going through some of your papers, seeing like people describe like feeling like they didn't even exist anymore, that they felt no emotions for their children, all of this kind of stuff. So there's a lot out there that can happen. And it seems like you're doing a really good job cataloging it and also figuring out how to support people. So, well, I think that are all questions I have for you today. Is there anything else that you think is relevant?
Just a plug for Cheetah House and the study. So we're still recruiting. We need 800 people in each arm. So if you have a meditation-related challenge at any point in your life, even if it's still ongoing, or a psychedelic challenge, you know, check out meditationchallenges.org or psychedeliccallenges.org. This will be the most comprehensive study on both meditation and psychedelic related adverse effects, probably in a while. I mean, I would say definitely currently, but probably for a while. It's over 1,000 questions. There's also an interview piece and a prospective like following you over a year piece as well. So check that out. And then if you've had meditation related problems or psychedelic problems that are not seeming to be addressed by the whatever services you've tried, come to Cheetah House, cheetah like the animal, house like a house, .org. And we have a number of people who have had meditation related challenges. That is, our care team is a peer support model. So people who have had challenges themselves have been given the runaround, you know, in the same way that you might have been, and have come out the other side with their own way of healing. And then we also have support groups where you can crowdsource, like, what did you do for this particular kind of symptom, and see that everybody has their own method, and feel empowered to develop your own method. So those are resources that are available to you. And yeah, come find us if you need to.
Thank you so much. All right.